This building was once appraised at $38 million, just $4 million this time around. That's an example of investors starting to find the bottom.
Good morning. It's March 11th, and this is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Farr.
And I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. Some in-house expertise today. We are chatting about office markets in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Chicago, and talking about whether these markets are starting to bottom out.
Yeah, so you'll hear from us and our Chicago bureau chief, Sam Lounsbury. We talked about some of the key deals that have transacted, admittedly at pretty steep discounts from their lost sales. We also chatted about office leasing stats and general sentiment across the three markets.
But first, the news.
Susanna, I'm going to start with you, New York Community Bank.
Yeah, so big day last Wednesday for New York Community Bank. The bank shares plunged 47% midday, and that prompted the New York Stock Exchange to halt trading for a few hours there. And we should go back a bit because New York Community Bank has been having a rough, month and change at this point.
And some of that pain stems from the bank's exposure to rent-stabilized multifamily loans in New York, right?
That's definitely a part of the story. I want to start last day of January. So the bank reports earnings. It's a surprise miss. And notably, it slashes its dividend and it also substantially expands its provision for credit losses. It ties that decision to its expectation that distress hitting office and multifamily is going to get worse. And we know that the bank's multifamily portfolio, its loan book, is about half rent stabilized, and multifamily loans make up 44% of its total loan book. So, you know, it's a good piece. So shares are down on this news. Then, a little over a week ago, the bank replaces its CEO, and it also discloses weaknesses with internal controls related to internal loan review. We see the stock drop again. Now we come to last week on Wednesday. The bank says it's looking for more money, and then we get that plunge, 47%. For context, shares before New York Community Bank reported earnings were trading, you know, at $10 mark, thereabouts. After it discloses it's looking for more money, they're down to $1.76. That's the low. The good news for the bank is it does end up scoring $1 billion equity infusion from a number of institutional investors, notably Liberty Strategic Capital. That's run by Steven Mnuchin, who's the former Treasury Secretary. It also appoints yet another CEO, former comptroller of the currency, Joseph Otting. And shares, you know, they perk up a little bit. They go up to $4.18 before they slip back down into the threes. And, you know, we're recording this Friday afternoon. They are currently trading at $3.40. So still a sizable differential from January 30th.
So it sounds like there was a slight vote of confidence there with that $1 billion equity pump. And Reuters had a story on Thursday about how NYCB's deposits have slipped 7% over the last month. It's definitely something to keep an eye on, given withdrawals are what contributed to the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, and Signature last year, but nowhere near the withdrawals that we saw then.
No, I don't think so. I was talking to an analyst today and he said, it's not great, but it's not at that level. Someone else told me, you know, it's not another Signature. So, and I think another thing that's good to note is that 80% of New York Community Bank's deposits are insured. So with Signature, we saw landlords shuffling around money because they were worried that the FDIC wouldn't cover it, which ultimately it did. And that could be another confidence booster for clients.
So on to other news. Two interesting hotels, respectively interesting hotels, came to market last week. In New York, the Row Hotel, which is a giant 1,300-key hotel on 8th Avenue, is up for sale. Two groups of investors are marketing both the interest in the ground underneath the hotel and the long-term lease that actually controls the hotel itself. They're asking a total of $350 million. What's interesting is that the hotel has recently been used by Eric Adams's administration as a shelter for migrant families. In 2022, the city signed a $40 million contract to rent out the hotel. And then on the other side of the country, the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles is up for sale.
That name is familiar to me. I feel like there's a Netflix documentary or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the subject of this documentary on Netflix called Crime Scene Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Ooh. At least 16 people have died on the premises, and it has become this lore that the hotel is haunted. It was originally built as a luxury hotel in the 1920s. It also served as inspiration for a season of American Horror Story.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Fun fact. Yeah. But in 2019, it was converted into affordable housing, specifically designed for those who have experienced homelessness. It's interesting, though, many units at the property have remained vacant. Ooh. Despite that conversion.
And one last plug, the March issue for our magazine came out last week. Lots of good stuff in there, per usual. Our cover story was about Miami and whether the city can keep its momentum or if the development boom and population growth are starting to peter out. So definitely check that out.
So on to our main event.
Hi, I'm Sam Lounsberry. I'm the Chicago Bureau Chief for The Real Deal.
So I want to start 1 year ago. We had this piece called Sizing Up Chicago's Office Market that was published in February 2023. And the thesis was that net absorption, so new leases minus new vacancies, actually rose by 42% in Chicago's Central Business District in 2022. The vacancy rate in 2022 was 22%, so still high, but there were more leases being signed, and a lot of them looked like new leases, not tenants re-upping. Sam, what has changed in the past year with Chicago's office market?
We've seen vacancy slightly uptick, nothing, no big surge, which is good for landlords, but demand is still much lower than it really needs to be for the market to be healthy. Tenants are still cautious about making decisions quickly. I think we're still very much in the phase of figuring out what tenants want for their work arrangements, what they want for their office footprint in the age of hybrid work, and you know how they're going to manage their real estate decision making.
And would you say there's a pretty large disparity between the demand that Class A is seeing versus Class B, C, and also the occupancy in those buildings?
There definitely is an ongoing flight to quality. Even the companies that are recommitting to the buildings that they're currently in, like we just saw JP Morgan Chase decide to remain in its longtime Central Loop headquarters for another long term. And they are, you know, pouring millions of dollars, it will be, into renovating, a full-on renovation of their office building in downtown Chicago. That's the same case for PNC Bank, which considered a move to a Wacker Drive Tower, but ultimately decided to stay in its Franklin Street headquarters and renovate that building as well. So definitely buildings that are either newly built in the last few years, coming out of the ground now, are attracting tenants, and those that aren't so new are having to make improvements to stay competitive and either retain their current tenants or backfill the spaces that they've lost in the last few years.
So the PNC move that it was considering, what would that have looked like spatially within Chicago?
They would have cut their footprints a little bit. That's what we're seeing. Companies that move into a newer development with better amenities tend to cut their footprints from what they had before. Even some companies that are remaining where they're at now, Mesereau financial firm, for instance, stayed in its current Clark Street building, but did decide to reduce its footprint for its next long-term lease that it just recommitted to at its property.
I wanted to ask about Chicago's tenant pool. What types of companies are still signing leases, and how has that changed from before the pandemic?
Chicago always likes to tout how diverse its economy is. And what we've seen in the last year is really a number of deals that kind of highlight that status. Insurers leases, we've seen, as I just said, some financial institutions, some real estate decisions here. We've seen some continued interest from tech firms, although there has been a probably broader pullback within that sector than some of the others. But it does remain a mix of tenants that have made some decisions lately.
Can you also talk about how the subleasing market is faring? I know in New York, leasing activity at the end of 2023 was down significantly from 2022, but sublease space was still in demand. I think it had reached its lowest level since the fourth quarter of 2021. That's according to Avis and Young.
We're still at a near record amount of sublease space on the market, nearly 8 million square feet. It's down a little bit from earlier on in the fallout from the pandemic. It had exceeded 8 million square feet of secondary sublease space on the market at one point. Leasing brokers say there's still a lot of sublease space on the market that needs to be churned through in order for landlords to be more competitive again with direct leasing. So there's a lot. And we're starting to see a little bit more sublease space pop up in even some of the hotter areas like Fulton Market. We've seen some smaller spaces go onto the market lately with some tech firms. And that's been really interesting because generally, Fulton Market has been more insulated from the real loss of occupancy that we've seen in some areas of the Loop, for instance.
So, Isabella, I want to compare that to what we're seeing in California, both in LA and also San Francisco. I know you can speak to both of those markets. To recap, Chicago, vacancy is still high, sublease space, we still need to see a little more demand for that, to put it lightly, and the flight to quality story is playing out. So how does that compare to California?
So I'll start in LA, where office vacancy is hitting a new record every single quarter. Before the pandemic, we didn't see office vacancy move above probably 15, 18% maybe, and now it's at 25%. And it really does depend on the submarket. LA is interesting because there are all these like little office hubs, right, sprawled out across LA. You can't just talk about like Manhattan, for example. So we've got two sides of the spectrum where Century City is seeing historic lows in vacancy. People love to be there. Office leases are being signed almost every day. There's a tower that is under construction by J&B Realty that is almost 65% occupied, and it doesn't even open until 2026. Companies are really saying, we want to be in Century City. Then you have downtown LA where, you know, some of the Class A office towers are 50% occupied. I had someone tell me the other day that it is completely unrealistic to think that you could get to 80, 90% occupied if you come in and buy one of those buildings. Moving on to San Francisco, office vacancy is also at record highs, right? So in and around downtown San Francisco, vacancy hit 6%. That's up 1.6 percentage points from the prior quarter, according to CBRE. And I think something that brokers have told me is that San Francisco's office market is so dependent on tech, as you can imagine. And so if the tech industry is having all these layoffs across the board, that directly impacts their office space. And they don't really have anyone to, they don't really have an industry that can come and fill that empty space.
Sounds like what's happening in San Francisco is sweeping. And then in Los Angeles, there are still some bright spots, depending on where you look, like Century City, as you highlighted.
Exactly. So there are still submarkets that are definitely in demand. Whereas San Francisco, I was going to say that NVIDIA, there's so much investor interest in actually buying that office campus. Unsolicited offers. And I think what's interesting is that investors seem to be interested in buildings where there's AAA credit tenants, they're not making any layoffs, and their stock price is like through the roof, right? So they're comfortable in that tenant staying there and that they're not going to shrink or have any sort of financial issues anytime soon. So there are definitely pockets of the Bay Area that are doing well, but it's really those campuses or those properties that have AAA credit tenants whose stock prices are doing really well, who aren't making any layoffs. It's very kind of company specific.
So let's get into distress a little bit more. We've seen a rise in foreclosures, I think we can say nationally, as far as office goes. Sam, in Chicago, there have been some keys handed back. There have been valuation declines. Can you give us an example of one notable distress event that's happened in the past year?
Sure. I think one that comes to mind would be 300 West Adams Street. It is a 12-story building that recently just sold to a venture controlled by Chicago-based investor Igor Gabal for $17 a square foot. That's about 90%, nearly 90% off of what this building last traded for.
I thought that 148 a square foot in LA was low.
Yeah, this building was once appraised at $38 million when it sold in 2012. So just $4 million this time around, almost 12 years later. So really quite dramatic for that building. That's an example of investors starting to find the bottom. And even on some bigger distress deals, we're starting to see some buyers get selected. The Jewelers Building, which is a $50+ million foreclosure lawsuit near Michigan Avenue and Wacker Drive, is getting set to turn over to a venture controlled by Mike Reschke and Clay Co., which is the largest tenant in that building. There is another distressed deal about to go down, a more than $200 million foreclosure, a more than $200 million loan foreclosure at 161 North Clark Street. A venture controlled by Farpoint Development has reportedly been selected as a buyer in that case. So we're starting to see investors get comfortable enough with the numbers to make some bids on these discounted buildings and reset prices and, you know, get them to values where they can deal with lower rents and meet the market where it's at in terms of what tenants are willing to put into their real estate.
Mm. And the foreclosures, are those a facet of loans maturing, or is it just performance has gotten so bad and maturity might be 5 years out or something like that?
It depends on the case. We've seen some investors decide to walk away from assets even a little ahead of maturity, where it's obvious that they're not going to be able to refinance or they have no interest in fighting that battle with interest rates on the rise. For instance, there was a venture that was controlled by the South Korean Postal Service at 150 North Michigan Avenue, decided to walk away from that building. It had paid around $120 million for that building well before the pandemic, and it just got sold for $60 million, so more than a 50% discount to a venture controlled by R2 Investment here in Chicago, R2 Companies here in Chicago, that's run by Matt Garrison. That's another example of investors willing to take a shot on office buildings if the number's right.
Isabella, so Sam talked about finding the bottom. You said 148. That's in LA.
It was actually 134.
134 in LA. To you, does that read as the bottom or is there lower to go?
Yeah, so I'll preface this by saying LA's office market has been at a standstill for a couple of years now. We really just haven't seen a lot of sales, mostly because of rising interest rates, but also because of the city of LA's new transfer taxes. There were little comps to go on. So there were all these studies that came out that said we were predicting office values in LA to drop up to 50 to 60%, but no one had really seen that happen yet. Besides like a couple of deals that had closed right before the city's transfer taxes, but everyone thought were just last ditch efforts to sell off an asset. But there have been a few sales over the last few months that investors and brokers have told me, okay, maybe we're starting to see the bottom now, and maybe investors are getting a little bit more comfortable with the idea that they're getting in at a low enough basis that a low occupancy at the building might pencil out, or they're actually comfortable then spending the extra cash to redo the building. So I'll give an example, 7 Wilshire Boulevard, that's the Aon Center. An investment firm called Carrollwood, run by Adam Rubin, just bought that building for $135 a square foot. So that's about a 45% discount from what the seller, Shorenstein Partners, had paid for it in 2014. And Adam had told me he was actually expecting values to keep falling even after that sale, but now it's become a guidepost. And I spoke to another prominent West Coast broker, Kevin Shannon, who said investors might be getting comfortable with the idea that maybe that 130 square foot range is the bottom. It doesn't necessarily that mean that the office market is going to recover anytime soon. It's not like we've hit the bottom and now we're on the way back up. Shannon said that there's going to be some ugly comps still, but I think it does give investors that were maybe sitting on the sidelines a clearer financial picture of where they could come in at.
What you just said, it's not like we're at the bottom and going to come back up. That's a nice transition into this Chicago Business Journal piece that we saw. I think it was just a few days into the new year, but it was citing Moody's and saying that there is potential in Chicago's office market heading into 2024. But it almost, to me, and Sam, I want you to speak to this, but it seemed like a saying that Chicago isn't as bad as everywhere else. And that's why it could get a little better. But what did you take out of that article? And how does it compare to what you're seeing on the ground?
Yeah, I think there is certainly opportunity in Chicago. People are willing to place bets on the office market here. As I said, a lot of the investors that are trying to snap up some of these distressed assets feel like there is a future. If you can turn around your property, put some additional investment into it. One thing I'll say about that 150 North Michigan Avenue sale was that these deals are really interesting in that they'll pay $60 million to own the asset, but the mortgage used for this deal will be for a little bit more than that, upwards of $70 million, I believe, in this case, because they're going to be using some of these funds to start improving and rehabilitating these buildings to get them in better position to compete with newer development. And so if you can work out deals like that where lenders are willing to hear your case out and say, hey, this is a great location. We think the public transportation system of Chicago is a draw. A lot of folks think that's why Google decided to buy the old James R. Thompson Center and make that its new Chicago headquarters opening up here in a couple of years was for the ease of access on public transportation. And that's the case that I think investors are making in Chicago, is that there's a wide range that the city draws its professional talent from. Like I said earlier, we've seen a very diverse mix of tenants making some decisions lately. I think law firms are leading the charge a little bit right now. We've seen them take some space in newer towers. Sterling Bay, for instance, landed about 90,000 square feet with Greenberg Traurig and Fulton Market. And then we've seen other types of tenants, insurers, some financial institutions make some decisions to stay put, actually, where they're at now. JP Morgan Chase, for instance, recommitting to its Central Loop Tower. PNC Bank, same thing, staying at its Franklin Street offices that it's kept for quite some time now. And other than that, we have seen a few tech firms make some moves, make some leases, but there has, I think, been a little bit of a broader pullback within that sector more generally from earlier during the pandemic or just before. So, you know, there's reasons to bet on the city that it will come back. It's just a matter of tenants deciding to pull the trigger, figuring out what kind of work arrangements they want moving forward in the kind of post-pandemic landscape, and investors and landlords being able to get to the bases that they need in order to pour more money into their assets and make them more competitive if they're not brand new.
I have a couple of points on that. First, I've heard that tenants want a landlord that is going to spend the money on the building, right? They want a landlord that is committed to the space. They don't want a landlord that's going to go into default and have end up in a situation where you're now dealing with a receiver, or you don't know who your landlord is going to be in 2 years, right? When you're signing a 30-year lease for a building, you want that stability. I think that there's a certain comfort if someone new is going to come in and say, okay, we're actually committed to spending money on this space. I think that provides less hesitation on behalf of the tenant, right? Some more confidence there. The second thing that I was going to say is, I don't know if this is the case in Chicago, and maybe we could chat about this, but the buyer pool that we're seeing in LA is really this new sect of investors. They're family offices, high net worth individuals, people that maybe didn't have the opportunity to come into office before, but now that prices are low, they can take that opportunity. And I've definitely heard that they're longer term holders too. They're not institutions that have a 3 to 5 year hold period and want to flip the building. They are really in it for the long haul. I don't know if that's the same case in Chicago.
It's really interesting you ask. I think right now, the couple of transactions I've mentioned, the buyers are local players, well-connected in the Chicago office market, and they have been around the block in this city. They've maybe specialized in turning around assets, rehabilitating well-located but older assets. I think we're starting to see institutions take a look again at big cities, but it's going to take some time, I think, for Chicago to really be at the top of mind for some of those larger institutions that really want to place their capital and kind of sit back without being too active in getting from a difficult place with a building to a more manageable one.
And Isabella, I want to take that have we bottom question to San Francisco. So earlier we mentioned 36% vacancy rate. That is among the highest, I think probably the highest nationally. How does that relate to valuation declines? And what do you think we're going to see going forward?
Yeah, so we've seen huge price reductions for buildings that have sold, on average 40% compared to last sale. But from what people tell me, there haven't been enough sales yet to determine whether or not San Francisco is hitting the bottom. In 2023, investment sales for office in San Francisco was down 66%. That's $800 million. The first time we've really seen investment sales in San Francisco drop below $1 billion. And for context, LA had $2.8 billion in sales. That's only down 7% from the year prior. And usually those numbers are a lot closer between LA and San Francisco. And New York, for comparison, had $5 billion in sales in 2023. That's down 46%. So we're seeing a lot of headlines of deep valuation cuts in San Francisco, but we still haven't seen a ton of sales actually trade. From the people that I've spoken to, they think that there's still a little bit of a ways to go. And I don't think investors are quite comfortable even making the decision to purchase office. And maybe it's because pricing is still too high. I'm not entirely sure there. Deconstruct is every Monday on Spotify, Apple, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're looking at single-family rentals. Tune in then.